The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One of the most profoundly disturbing, distressing, depressing aspects of British public debate over the last 18 months has been the extent to which it has revealed very senior British politicians' profound ignorance of relationships with our neighbours in Ireland, a lack of affinity and understanding with the fragility of the peace that was hard won and secured by politics and can assuredly be undone by politics unless the right steps are taken.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 13th, 2018. On Tuesday, the New York Times reported that UK and EU officials have reached a provisional Brexit agreement. Though as of this recording, the text of that agreement has not been released, we at Lawfare thought it would be a good time for a refresher on how senior Europe experts and British officials are thinking about the UK's split from the European Union. On October 23rd, the Brookings Center on the United States and Europe hosted a panel discussion on the endgame of Brexit negotiations with Sir Kim Darroch, Britain's ambassador to the United States, Amanda Sloat, senior fellow at Brookings, Douglas Alexander, who was the UK's shadow foreign secretary, and Lucinda Creighton, a former Irish minister for European affairs. Edward Luce of the Financial Times moderated the discussion. They talked about some of the thorniest issues at stake in Britain's departure, including the unresolved trade issues between the UK and EU, how Scotland, whose residents overwhelmingly opposed leaving the EU in the 2016 referendum, may react to Brexit, and the risks Brexit poses to a peaceful future in Northern Ireland. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 364, The UK and Europe on the Brink of Brexit.
So, Kim, I'm going to you not because not to persecute you, but because you've been Britain's ambassador to the EU. You were national security advisor to the British Prime Minister, and you're now, of course, Britain's ambassador here in the United States. You have deep experience of representing the British government and speaking on its behalf. What is your prognosis of these three scenarios? The slightly apocalyptic no deal scenario, the May gets it all done and squeaks it through Parliament scenario, and the, until recently, fantastical people's vote scenario, but perhaps slightly less fantastical now. What are you looking at as the probabilities here?
Well, Ed, thanks for that colourful introduction. And thanks for coming to me first. And you have presented what feels rather like one of those Foreign Office submissions with three options for ministers where we want them to choose the middle one. And so I'm going to choose the middle one, but let me explain why. The withdrawal agreement, which is the agreement between the EU and the 27, which covers all of our leaving arrangements, is, as the Prime Minister said in the House of Commons yesterday, 95% done. And we have provisional agreements on money, on the rights of EU citizens living in the UK and the rights of UK citizens living in Europe, and most of the rest of the leaving arrangements. The hardest part was always going to be around the deal on what happens on the Irish border, and so it is proving. But let's remember, we have got 95% of the way there. If we get the free trade deal that is embodied in the Chequers proposal. Of course, there isn't really an issue over the Irish border. That gets solved, and that is Plan A. So the debate is about a backstop arrangement if that negotiation should not be completed in the implementation period, the transitional period, which runs until the end of December 2020. And that's not where we expect to be or want to be. So we're talking about a contingency that we hope never happens. Now, we still have some time. There's another European Council in December. It's still possible there could be an extra European Council at some point in November. We all of us want the same objective. The Commission, the British government, the Irish government, and the other member states, which is no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So I am confident that we can get there and get a deal. Then you also need to do a political agreement about the future. I did maybe 30 or 40 big European negotiations in my time doing this work, my 15 years doing this work. I'm confident that is achievable with the usual creativity that the specialists and the technicians bring to drafting political agreements. So I'm relatively confident about getting the deal with our European partners. I would accept that it looks quite a tight vote in the House of Commons when you bring that agreement to the House of Commons. But I think there's a lot of talk now that you see in the newspapers, usually unnamed MPs who are saying they won't be able to vote for it. I think when there is a text for them to look at, and when they consider the alternatives, that will concentrate minds. I think that government has the whips of its machinery and can encourage its MPs to support. It can do deals with other groups. So my money is on her, despite all the predictions at the moment, getting the deal through the House of Commons and getting to that place.
Thank you. So just very briefly, because I want to move to Lucinda. I mean, we hope for the best, but we prepare for the worst. To what degree is sort of contingency no-deal planning happening in the British government?
As the government has said, there is contingency planning going on in Whitehall, and I know that there are colleagues back in Whitehall who are looking at all of this. We're also trying to find a way through that involves a deal, not no deal. So there's quite a lot going on in Whitehall. But yes, we are doing contingency planning for that. But it is absolutely not the expectation and not the plan. The plan is that we get to a deal with our European colleagues in the next month and a half, and that we then get that deal through the House of Commons.
Lucinda, your political career has been very, very much engaged with Europe, but also, of course, Ireland. And it spanned the sort of integration of Europe. You were Ireland's Minister for Europe. You were a member of the European Parliament. You've dealt with the Irish presidency of the European Union. So you're steeped in this stuff. That same time period has also been the entrenchment and the success of the Good Friday Agreement that has achieved peace in Ireland. How fearful are you that that is now in jeopardy? To what degree is your no-deal contingency planning in Ireland now a sort of live activity?
So I think the risks surrounding this final phase of the negotiations are very high. There is a huge degree of concern in Dublin and in Belfast and across the island around the prospect of a deal not being concluded. I think it probably will. I spent a lot of my time in Brussels, and I think there's a real desire. I also spent a lot of my time in London, and I think there is a desire on both parts or both sides to do a deal. So I agree with Kim on that. But I think the arithmetic in the House of Commons, and I'm sure Douglas will talk about this from his direct experience of being a member of the Parliament of Westminster, I think it's a highly risky scenario. So there is a lot of planning across government departments in Dublin. It's a difficult thing to plan for. So there's a lot of sort of theoretical planning underway. I think the implementation of that is very unclear. And I think that there is a legitimate and a really deep emotional concern in Ireland around the political future on the island. It's a very sensitive topic in London and those who advocate for Brexit and even possibly for no deal really don't like the issue of the peace process in Northern Ireland to be raised at all. They think it's scaremongering and fearmongering. And they were really angry when Leo Varadkar, our Taoiseach Prime Minister, raised it at the European Council last week. But he was right to raise it because, you know, peace is hard won. And it's very fragile and it's very easily lost. And, you know, I concluded my high school exams, the Leaving Cert in 1998. And so I suppose I come from that generation which, you know, through our childhood witnessed on our televisions every single evening bombs, not just in Northern Ireland, by the way, but also in Britain, which devastated people's lives. Thousands of people killed, and that is something that the people across the island of Ireland are deeply concerned about maintaining and preserving the peace process, and we don't take it for granted, and we are really concerned about what a no-deal scenario could potentially unleash if there isn't agreement before March and probably by the end of this year. So this is a real risk, a real threat, and something that that Irish people are really concerned about.
Douglas, you're steeped in British politics. You were Minister for Europe in the last Labour government. You were Secretary of State for Scotland, which of course we're going to bring into this conversation. And you were opposition spokesman, shadow spokesman on foreign affairs. Given your parliamentary experience, you're now at Harvard, of course, which is not where most left-behinds are, but you're still you're still in a pole position to observe and, with your experience, judge the prospects here. Given your parliamentary experience and given the leadership of your party, Jeremy Corbyn, as at best a lukewarm pro-European, but somebody who didn't turn up to the march last Saturday, what are the chances something could go wrong in this vote and we could crash into a hard no-deal situation?
Well, I think the risks are very real and the jeopardy is very great. There is, of course, a negotiating risk. Can the two sides find common ground on the issue of the backstop? There was agreement on that at the December Council in 2017, but the smartest minds in London and Dublin and in Brussels so far have not managed to find a formulation. But in classic negotiation theory, both sides want to find that common ground, and the consequences of not finding that common ground, for all the reasons we've just heard from Lucinda, are extremely severe. So my hope would be that in the immediate days and weeks ahead, we will see progress in relation to the negotiations. But in December of 2017, there wasn't simply agreement reached on the Irish backstop. There was also an undertaking given by Theresa May under pressure from her own backbenchers in the House of Commons that there would be a meaningful vote on the outcome of the negotiations. And so I think we need to countenance not just the negotiation risk, but a ratification risk. And the reason that there is such febrile speculation across the United Kingdom at the moment is there is no majority in Parliament for any of the negotiation outcomes that are under contemplation. And while I admire Kim's characteristic British understatement and calm under fire in suggesting that this will all be resolved, I have to say, as we say in Scotland, I hae my doots. I have my doubts is because it seems to me that the Democratic Unionist Party may well not support their partners in the Conservative Party when it comes to this issue of the character of the relationship between Northern Ireland and the Republic. There are a whole number of Conservative MPs who have already declared that they're not prepared to support the deal as it's under contemplation. And so the working assumption in Downing Street right now seems to be that the Labour Party will step in and save Theresa May. And I have to say, I am deeply, deeply sceptical that you will see anything like the number of Labour MPs that the Conservative Whip's Office are presuming would support Theresa May in those circumstances actually tripping through the division lobbies. And in that sense, I think even if we were to see a breakthrough in the negotiations between the United Kingdom and Brussels in the coming weeks, then the drama moves to the House of Commons. And at the moment, I don't see that there is a parliamentary majority for any of the proposals that are actually on the table.
And we should mention, I should add on to your compliment to Kim's wonderful diplomatic poker face that shortly after Trump was elected, he tweeted that Nigel Farage should be the new ambassador. But nobody, nobody in London even heard this or read this tweet. Marvelous sang Freud there. Amanda, I want to get into the constitutional and devolution sort of questions that are implied by this, but let's just start on the immediate. What the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, which of course props up the Theresa May government, without them there's no majority, what their concerns are with the Chequers plan and with the border agreement, with the implications for keeping an open border implied by the Chequers plan. What is the DUP concern there, and why is this such a theological issue for conservative Brexiteers?
It really has been a perfect storm of events. I mean, you remember that Theresa May became prime minister following the resignation of David Cameron after the Brexit referendum. A year in, she decided to hold snap elections as a way of strengthening her negotiating position going into Brexit, and had a disastrous result, losing her parliamentary majority and then becoming dependent on the DUP for government. At the same time, it's also worth noting that Northern Ireland has been without an assembly for over 500 days. So at this critical time when we're discussing Northern Ireland's future, the only voice that's coming out is the voice of the Democratic Unionist Party, which is propping up Theresa May's government in London. And there really is no voice otherwise coming out of Belfast. When I was in Northern Ireland in May doing research on this report, I met with a DUP representative who had been very senior and involved in these campaigns. And the way he articulated it was that the DUP recognizes that Northern Ireland has special circumstances, but they don't want Northern Ireland to be given a special status. And what the DUP has always been very concerned about with the backstop is the idea that you would essentially create a border in the Irish Sea and that you would be treating Northern Ireland separately from the rest of Great Britain. In many ways, what's offered in the backstop would be the best of both worlds economically for Northern Ireland, because they would be able to still participate within the EU single market and customs union, but they would be operating within the UK framework. For the DUP, this raises very unacceptable status issues for them in terms of the larger constitutional situation within the United Kingdom, and therefore has become an anathema to their political position.
And you, as an American, you're the only non-European on this. How do you assess the Trump administration's role in all of this? Because Tom was mentioning earlier in the introduction that a traditional American administration would be trying to finesse and help sort of insert itself constructively into these divorce negotiations. That's not happening, though, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, it's been unclear in some ways what the U.S. position actually is. You had President Obama, who, of course, was very forward-leaning in terms of supporting Remain. He went to London several months before the Brexit referendum, expressed American support for a strong U.K. within a strong EU, suggested that the U.K. would be at the back of the queue in terms of free trade negotiations with the U.S. if it went forward with Brexit. Trump has taken a very different approach. He called Brexit a great thing. He has referred to the EU as a foe, and I think in its worst case is actually supportive of the weakening of the EU and potentially breaking countries away from the EU. It's been surprising that the U.S. has not been more involved in these negotiations on the face of it, particularly on the Northern Ireland side. The U.S., of course, for decades supported the Northern Ireland peace process. We had Majority Leader George Mitchell very actively involved in shepherding the Good Friday agreements. But I think the U.S. really has not played a very active role. I think the U.S. government has assessed that it is not in its interest to have the U.K. crash out with no deal. That would be very damaging in geoeconomic terms. The State Department has made quiet demarches at various periods in the process to encourage progress towards a deal. But the U.S. really has not played the role that we might see from some traditional U.S. administrations in terms of putting pressure on both sides, and in particular trying to find a way forward on Northern Ireland.
Of course, it's not just Kim, whose job was voluntarily gazumped by Trump, but when Trump was in Britain, he suggested Boris Johnson would make a great prime minister. So he's got a habit here. Kim, I'm not going to ask.
Another great
you
intro.
That. I'm not going to ask either of those questions. That's why I was. Kim, you're one of the sort of great claims of the Brexit campaign and the Brexiteers was a post-Brexit UK-US trade deal, big free trade agreement between the US and the UK. Now, clearly, Britain wouldn't be in the position to negotiate this, and America wouldn't want to negotiate this until we knew the arrangements post-Brexit. Yeah. We knew exactly. Trump did say one reasonable thing when he was in Britain about this, which was if Britain is de facto in the customs union, not formally but de facto, in order to keep that Irish border open, then it's going to be very hard to negotiate with Britain a separate trade deal. That was a pretty reasonable point, right? Mm. What are the prospects for assuming Chequers is the basis for the divorce agreement? What are the prospects, therefore, for the great prize, supposed prize of Brexit, namely a trade deal with America?
Prime Minister and the President have talked about this at each of the last several meetings that I've attended, most recently in New York about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And we are keen on a free trade agreement, and the President always says consistently how keen he and his administration are on it and how they will be ready to start negotiating just as soon as we are. We have this implementation period running from 29 March 2019 to 31 December 2020, in which we can negotiate. I think we can even sign. The only thing you can't do in that period is actually implement the agreements. You can't implement until we have left everything at the end of December 2020. We've set up a trade investment working group, which has met four times under Bob Lighthizer and Liam Fox, and that is the structure in which we will negotiate it when it happens. So everything is ready to go, and I'm confident once we have left on 29 March that we will start those negotiations quickly. The scope of the negotiations, you're right, Ed, and just how far we can go in terms of what freedom we have to set our own tariff levels and so on, we'll have to wait and see. We'll have to wait and see where we get to in terms of the future relationship between the UK and the EU, the free trade deal we want there, and how close we are to EU regulation and so on. But political will is there. US takes 20% of British exports, so it's already our biggest single bilateral trading partner. There is huge potential for a lot more, including particularly in the whole services sector. So this will be a top priority for the government once we are out.
Lucinda, I'll get to you in a moment, but Douglas, I mean, is it fair to say that if we did get into the position where technically the US and the UK could start a big trade deal, that would be an ideal Trumpian position, which is we're bigger, you're smaller? Well, it would be Britain playing Ireland.
I find myself having to disagree with Kim, not because he hasn't eloquently described the position of the government, but the position of the government is a post-imperial fantasy. You know, let's be clear, I was the Trade, Investment and Foreign Affairs Minister in a previous British government, and the idea that Donald Trump is willing and waiting to do an ultra-generous deal with the United Kingdom seems to me to be optimistic, to put it at its most generous. The fact is, trade negotiators are pretty unsentimental people. It comes down to arithmetic and psychology. And if you look at the arithmetic, if you're sitting as a trade negotiator with 500 million citizens behind you, as we do at the moment as part of the EU28, then the deal that you're able to strike is fundamentally different than if you're sitting with 65 or 70 million consumers behind you. And at the same time, we're dealing with a president who got elected on a promise of putting America first. So the idea that he is, for reasons of sentiment, historic reasons of the special relationship, desperate to do a deal that helps the United Kingdom seems to me to be consistent with a view that's been really there from the outset from the Brexiteers, which is that somehow by leaving the European Union, Britain will stand taller in Washington or in Beijing or in Moscow, and that we will somehow become a kind of buccaneering North Atlantic Singapore. And to my mind, there really is literally no evidence to that effect. Incidentally, even on the so-called implementation period, the implementation period in reality is going to be a period during which a political declaration is translated into a legally binding treaty between the United Kingdom and the 27, no serious country is going to engage in a meaningful way in trade negotiations with the United Kingdom until they know the character of the United Kingdom's relationship in terms of future trade with the EU27 on our doorstep. So I think the idea that immediately at the beginning of April, if we are in that scenario, that the rest of the world is going to rush to Britain's door to sign free trade agreements is just another iteration of the conversation I'm afraid we were hearing from the Brexiteers 2 years ago, that as soon as Brexit happened, there was going to be a gathering rush of countries to do trade deals with the United Kingdom. As a citizen of the United Kingdom, I might wish that was true, but I see perilous little evidence that it's going to be true.
Let me just pick up on that fantasy theme. Because, I mean, that's a fantasy that one can laugh at because it's not yet got real-world implications. This deal could involve all kinds of unpopular things in Britain, like having to eat import chlorinated chicken.
I was going to say, all you have to do is say chlorinated chicken and Brits shudder.
Yes, and opening the National Health Service.
Privatising the National Health Service.
And GM foods, exactly. But the fantasy theme is also extended to Ireland. I mean, you've had very senior British Conservative politicians like Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, of course, Michael Gove to some extent, talking in a very sort of slapdash fashion about what Ireland could do to accommodate itself to Britain's decision. Rees-Mogg the other day said, oh, well, we can have people on the borders checking people who cross the borders like we had during the Troubles. Boris Johnson has talked of computers solving it all, that you don't need any sort of checks on the border. We can actually crash out entirely of the customs union and keep that. How is this kind of... And, of course, we've had the Irexit talk. Well, you should leave the EU too and just come in with us in our own customs union, which we would call the British Isles.
I think we've heard that one before.
You've heard that one before. You've seen this movie before, and you're sitting in a way more comfortable seat now, so you're a much more secure country. Nevertheless, to what degree is this sort of bringing up rather bad memories and changing the political climate in the Republic?
It's a very big question in a sense. I mean, on the one hand, the relationship has clearly, you know, deteriorated in the last couple of years since June 2016. You know, we had a high point in bilateral relations when Queen Elizabeth visited in 2011 and came to Ireland and travelled around the country. And, you know, there was a really strong bilateral relationship and personal relationships as well between the various Taoiseach and a series of prime ministers. And certainly, you know, those relationships have been strained in the last 2 years. And of course, offence is taken by some of the remarks from some cabinet members and some leading lights within the Conservative Party. However, I would say I think we've gotten to the point in Ireland where we're actually a little bit desensitised to some of the nonsense coming from some of those people. So, you know, when Boris Johnson's father intervenes and says, well, if Irish people want to shoot at each other, that's fine. At this point, I don't think anybody's taking that sort of nonsense seriously. And likewise, when, you know, and Boris Johnson wasn't the only one to talk about, you know, technical solutions to the border question. I mean, that was a very serious line of thought within the Conservative Party and within the government.
The MaxFAC,
maximum facilitation. So, you know, these are quite serious ideas that have been floated, but one by one, they've all been batted away because they're nonsense.
I have heard the MaxFAC described as a clusterfuck. that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, but you know, so yes, it's offensive, and yes, it sets back our relations. But I mean, you're right. I mean, Ireland as a country is a much more, firstly, economically successful place than it was in 1973 when we joined the European Communities. You know, we have learned to stand on our own 2 feet. I mean, being part of the European Union and the European project has given us as a nation a self-confidence that did not exist heretofore. And that has actually been amplified over the last few years in particular. So, you know, while Ireland actually currently has the fastest growing economy in the European Union, Unfortunately, the UK economy has actually slowed down very, very significantly. So, you know, we have a sense of confidence about our economy, about our society, about our politics, and, you know, nothing, you know, no degree of insults that might be flung at us by certain individuals in British politics will impact on that. And if anything, you know, we definitely feel a stronger, more assured member of the European Union as well. I mean, there were many in London who doubted the solidarity between EU member states and who said, oh, well, you know, Berlin and Paris, when it comes down to it, will choose London over Dublin because of the strength and size of the UK. But in reality, as we have seen, European solidarity and a view that those countries who wish to remain within the European Union, the single market and the customs union, will stick together and will defend the values and principles that underpin that union. And Ireland has benefited from that. And that's why many are surprised to this day, even though we've been having these same conversations for at least 12 months around the border, around the peace process, and around this issue of a backstop, you know, all of the predictions about fragmentation, about divide and conquer within the EU have been proven wrong. And in fact, Dublin's insistence at every stage that that there would be solidarity has proven to be correct. And I have absolutely no doubt that that will continue right to the end of this process.
Douglas, briefly, because I want to ask Amanda.
Lucinda was very gracious in dismissing the insults, but one of the most profoundly disturbing, distressing, depressing aspects of British public debate over the last 18 months has been the extent to which it has revealed very senior British politicians' profound ignorance of relationships with our neighbours in Ireland, a lack of affinity and understanding with the fragility of the peace that was hard won and secured by politics and can assuredly be undone by politics unless the right steps are taken. And if I'm absolutely honest, I think it's revealing of the character of the modern Conservative Party. This used to be the Conservative and Unionist Party. What we're witnessing, I believe, in the United Kingdom today is the rise of English nationalism wrapped in the Union Jack. Mm. And actually, what it's revealing is that many members of the Conservative and Unionist Party, because they still travel under that name, have a cavalier disregard for the interests of the integrity of the United Kingdom. And in their minds, if the cost of a so-called clean Brexit is the breakup of the United Kingdom, then that to them is a price that they would countenance paying. And that is, I'm afraid, a very mainstream opinion now within the Conservative Party, both in Parliament and certainly in its membership across the country.
Amanda, you've written a very good paper, partly to accompany this panel, about the constitutional implications within Britain for this. Now, Douglas has sort of referred to the Irish reaction, and Lucinda's spoken about that. You have got talk, the Taoiseach included, of a referendum for United Ireland. It's certainly much more live talk of a second Scottish referendum. I've heard, in reference to Douglas's concerns about some of the ugliness of the debate in Britain, I've heard, you know, the acronymic description of what a Britain without Northern Ireland and Scotland would be, which is former United Kingdom of England and Wales, F-U-K-E-W, which I think would be a sort of an apt expression of some of the sentiment you're talking about. How likely is that in practice, though? The Scottish aren't looking for a referendum right now because they wouldn't win it, right?
Well, I think there's a lot of referendum fatigue in Scotland right now. They, of course, had a referendum in 2014, and as we were talking about earlier, I think we have learned that referenda do not answer these questions for generations. In fact, they continue to keep these questions alive. So there is fatigue over that. I think having seen the messiness of Brexit divorce, it highlights, in fact, how messy Scotland-UK divorce would be. And also the discussion about Northern Ireland shows that if the UK is out of the customs union and single market, and Scotland wanted to rejoin the EU, you would then need to have some sort of hard border with Scotland and England as a result of that. So I think the questions have become a lot more complicated in Scotland. I think a lot of this is going to depend on how Brexit plays out. People in Scotland voted, I think it was 68% to remain. So there was
62%.
So there was overwhelming support in Scotland for staying in. Certainly there has historically been a feeling in Scotland that they are being dictated to by a government government in London that they don't necessarily support and share the same views with. And the one thing I talk about in my paper that I think is sort of wonky constitutional, but really matters, is this question of where powers from Brussels are going to return when they come back to the UK. And this has, in fact, become one of the big debates in Scotland that could motivate questions potentially for a second independence referendum. When the Scottish Parliament, the other devolved governments were set up, the way the Scotland Act was written was that a number of powers were going to be reserved to Westminster, things like foreign affairs and trade, and everything else was going to be devolved to Scotland. So when powers come back from the EU, like environment, agriculture, fisheries, many in Scotland, particularly the Scottish National Party, but others, say these powers are not reserved, and so they should be coming back to us. And this actually has gone to the Constitutional Court in the UK and is continuing to play out as a live issue as to who actually controls these powers. If they are controlled by London for the sake of having a single market within the UK on things like agriculture and fisheries, you're going to have to deal with questions from the Scots, the Welsh, the Northern Irish about how they are involved in these discussions in London in terms of domestic policymaking within the UK.
I mean, in practical terms, the Scottish are not going to suddenly be waved into the EU, right? The Spanish are not going to want the Catalans to see that happening. There's going to be all kinds of forces discouraging. And from what I understand, Scottish public opinion is sort of paying heed to that. Do they really want this kind of... sort of reverse direction Brexit with all the sort of agonizing...
Although I and Douglas can weigh in, but I think Brexit has changed the calculation a little bit. I mean, I think from the Spanish perspective, if this was a constitutional process, that you had a referendum in the UK and Scotland were to become independent through constitutional means, that answers some of the questions about this illegal referendum in Catalonia a couple of years ago. And I think Brexit is the UK leaving the EU and Scotland wanting to remain. So that's a different question from Scotland seeking to become independent from the UK and then trying to get a back door into the EU. Scotland, I think, it would have to reapply for EU membership, but given that they currently implement all of the legislation, I think that would be a fairly easy case for them to make. And I think opinion seems to be evolving somewhat in the European Commission and Spain and some of the others about this question.
Douglas, as a Scot, do you want to...
Well, I genuinely believe, as of today, the greatest threat to the integrity of the United Kingdom is not Scottish nationalism, but English nationalism. We made our choice back in 2014 by a 10-point margin, 45% to 55%. The choice was to stay within the United Kingdom. In the mind of the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, she believed that that vote, where Scotland did vote to remain as part of the Brexit referendum in 2016... would be the spark, the provocation that would spike support for independence up above 50%. And in fact, to change my metaphors, that was the dog that never barked. We really have not seen any significant change in the opinion polls in the months since 23rd of June 2016. And in that sense, I think there has been what Bill Clinton used to call a teachable moment, as we've witnessed the attempts to try and come to terms with the breakup of a 40-year union when contemplating the possibility of breaking up a 300-year union between Scotland and England. And the reality is that public opinion in Scotland at the moment remains opposed to independence. If you look again objectively at what were the reasons why, as Scots, we made that choice, one of the reasons was economic, that very clearly the nationalists were unable to make the case that there were credible answers on the currency, on European membership, as you describe, but also on the fiscal position, given the volatility of the oil price. Each one of those issues have actually become more difficult, not more straightforward, as a consequence of Brexit. So in that sense, I think, you know, Nicola Sturgeon, notwithstanding those difficulties, said she was going to call a second referendum and sought that mandate and proceeded to lose 21 of her seats in the House of Commons in the general election of 2017. So I certainly wouldn't want to leave you with the impression that Scotland is champing at the bit for another referendum or indeed for independence. Far from it. On the other hand, my sense is, if the nationalists are able to persuade people that there should be another referendum, they would fight the next referendum not on economics, but on emotion, on the inhospitability of being part of a little Britain outside of the United Kingdom, led by the likes of Boris Johnson or Jacob Rees-Mogg. And in that sense, I do think that there are very real threats to the integrity of the United Kingdom represented by the present government and the course that it's been set. But I think Scots at the moment have a view that says if we've shot ourselves in the foot, then let's not cut off our leg.
Let's stick with referendums for a moment and the sort of radical scenarios. One of which, of course, is a no-deal Brexit, another of which is a people's vote for the whole of Britain to have a second bite at the apple. Kim, a lot of people, and as Lucinda mentioned, the degree of EU unity in these talks has been perhaps underestimated, certainly by the Brexiteers. They've been quite clear that our interests are with the member state involved here, and that's Ireland, and you're leaving a club. In a sort of extreme scenario where, you know, we might be heading towards a no-deal Brexit, which would not just damage Britain, it would damage Ireland, it would damage Europe. Do you think some of the sort of strong, some would argue fairly rigid European negotiating lines on the four freedoms of goods, that if you've got to have all four or none, which is goods, services, capital and people, do you think that if it comes to sort of a blinking, who blinks first situation, there might be more flexibility in Europe, given your Brussels negotiating experience?
Just before I answer that, Ed, very quickly, I mean, we are not on the other side from the Irish government, for example, on the issue of the border between the Republic and Northern Ireland. We're on the same side. We are both committed to no hard border between Northern Ireland mm-hmm. and the Republic of Ireland. So we are trying to do is work together to find a politically acceptable solution on that. The easy one, of course, is we get a free trade deal, and then there is no question about what happens on the border. And so that's why the issue of the Plan B of the backstop is the one that's outstanding. So, you know, this isn't a kind of adversarial position. On your question, I'm personally not surprised at the way that the negotiations have unfolded. If we get into a no-deal Brexit outcome, we will survive, but it will be, I think, damaging to both sides, to the Europeans and to us. It's obviously much, much better, therefore, if we can find a way through. For the reasons I explained, set out in my first answer, I'm hopeful that we can. As I said, 95% of the withdrawal deal is done. The other task that we have to do is a political statement on the future, which needs to be substantive and detailed enough to provide for the meaningful vote that we've promised in the House of Commons. But it's going to be a political declaration, not a full legal agreement, which we will then need to negotiate afterwards. But it's difficult for me to see why, given the disadvantages of any other approach, why it shouldn't be possible to reach that political outcome at either the Special European Council or the December European Council. So, you know, I'm hopeful, optimistic. You know, we will see as the President often says, we'll see what happens next.
We'll see what happens next. And you've got an admirable assumption that other people share your rationality to this, but of course the key actors here are not necessarily weighing up things in a judicious manner. My question is whether that also applies to the Europeans. I mean, Lucinda, you've also got rich experience in Europe. The assumption by the British, or many people in Britain, has been Merkel is more sympathetic to a pragmatic deal. Mm. Angela Merkel would be more sympathetic to something ad hoc that would suit Britain. And whereas Macron is a lot more theological on, you have rules of a club and we're not going to bend them. Might that change, the same question as I posed to the ambassador, might that change in extreme sort of game of chicken circumstances as we approach the deadline?
I think Merkel is a great friend of the UK, and you know, going back to the sort of the sort of slow motion car crash, as I see it, which led to the referendum in the UK, you know, all through that period where David Cameron was trying to negotiate some sort of a compromise, you know, some sort of deal that could work for the UK and would allow him to go back and have this referendum, but convince voters to stay in. Merkel held joint cabinet meetings with the British government. You know, ministers were, I mean, there was huge intensity in that relationship. So she is, I mean, I genuinely can say there's probably nobody around the table in the European Council as sorry as she is to see what has unfolded. But to interpret that as a willingness to compromise on the fundamental pillars of the European Union, the four freedoms, I think is to grossly misunderstand her. She is totally wedded to the free movement of people, and she is totally committed to maintaining the integrity of the single market and the customs union. So that is not just a French position. That is fundamentally a German position. And I've listened for the last 2 years to people in London saying, oh, yeah, but the German car manufacturers, you know, they're going to lean on the German government, and there's going to be some sort of a compromise, a last minute deal around this. And I think that that's completely wrong. And I think it's been proven to be wrong. And frankly, Merkel has faced them down at every stage and has made it clear. I mean, has effectively issued communiques to German industry to say, you know, the single market is non-negotiable, and it is a fundamental principle. And Germany really sees itself as the custodian of those ideals, those European ideals. So if anything, you know, the risk of fragmentation makes that commitment stronger from a German point of view. So no is the answer. I don't see any wavering on that. And I don't see pressure coming, as has been anticipated in London since the beginning of the process, pressure coming from Germany and Paris on Dublin to somehow water down the language around the backstop and the border. That's not going to happen. And I think people are really misunderstanding what the European project is about and what it means to France and Germany if they think that's going to happen.
Of course, as we were discussing at lunch, even if Merkel were playing that role that some in Britain hope she would be, there's no guarantee she'll even have a government or be in government by next March 2019.
This is a huge problem. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, this is a problem for Europe as a whole, which is, you know, the diminution of her influence and power and her weakened position in Germany. There's no question about that. And also, I mean, Macron, in a sense, is emboldened, you know, has a strong mandate and a big majority in Parliament, but is really, really struggling in opinion polls. And now there's this test case in terms of what they're going to do for the European elections in this sort of liberal alliance that he's pulling together. There are a lot of variables, but I think the one thing that is certain is that the European, the existing 27, including, you know, some countries that have had pretty controversial disputes at European Council level, Hungary, Poland and so on, I mean, they have all pretty fundamentally been unified around the four freedoms. And I think that is set to continue. So yes, I mean, Merkel is a pragmatist. Yes, she wants a deal with the UK, but it will be a deal on the terms of the basic fundamental principles of the European Union.
So let's get to the other extreme scenario, possibly for most of the types of people in this room, a benign extreme scenario, which is that march last Saturday does bear fruit. It is the largest march in recent history, although it's worth pointing out that the last largest march was against the Iraq war and that didn't work. But nevertheless, this is 700,000 people. In order to get that fantasy scenario of a second referendum, you're going to need one of the leaders of the two main parties to support it, aren't you? You're going to need Jeremy Corbyn to have a road to Damascus moment, or else in some sort of scenario, to be ousted and replaced by somebody else, which I think is probably even less likely at this point than having a second referendum. What are the chances, in your view, that pro-European members of the Labour Party, like yourself, people like yourself who are still in politics, can point to Corbyn and say, look, 3 out of 4 Labour voters want Britain to remain in Europe. These are your people. There are, to put it very crudely, 1.6 million more young voters in the British electorate than there were 2 years ago, and the young tend to be more pro-Europe. Mm. And to put it even more crudely, 750,000 fewer older voters because of mortality. That the opinion polls show that it would probably win. Opinion polls can't be trusted, but nevertheless, there is a strong argument you can make to Corbyn that you've just got to get with the tide here. What are the chances that argument is going to make headway in the coming weeks?
Well, I don't really think the argument that you've set out would come as news to Jeremy Corbyn, and that has not shifted the position that he's adopted. The position that was carefully negotiated at the Labour Party conference after many hours of negotiation was that the option of a second vote was kept on the table, but only in circumstances where first there had been deadlock in Parliament, and then the option of a general election had been rejected. And I think in terms of those 750,000 people on the streets of London at the weekend, that actually is the only credible route by which their aspiration will be fulfilled, which would be that we do see all of the possible alternatives, even a deal that's negotiated, voted down in the House of Commons towards the end of this year or at the very beginning of next year. The Labour Party, naturally, as the party of opposition at that point, agitating for a general election, although let's remember there is still the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which is a consequence of the last coalition government, and them being unsuccessful in precipitating a general election. I find it personally very hard to believe that even Conservatives angry with Theresa May over the deal that she brings back from Brussels are likely to walk into the division lobbies if the consequence of walking into the division lobbies is to put themselves in front of the British people anytime soon. I think both the Democratic Unionist Party and the Conservative Party are deeply fearful of losing a general election to Jeremy Corbyn, and so this Parliament will probably last a bit longer than quite a lot of the heated commentary at the moment suggests. But in those circumstances, in some ways, the question is as much for Theresa May as for Jeremy Corbyn. If her proposals have been rejected, if Parliament is deadlocked, she won't countenance a general election. Could there be circumstances in which she said, well, we've tried our best, Parliament is deadlocked, we have to take this back to the people, and at that point have a second vote? That would certainly require the support of the EU27 in terms of a unanimous commitment to extend the Article 50 timetable. I think that would be forthcoming in those circumstances, but it's a huge if, and you're absolutely right in your observation, which is in a parliamentary democracy, which notwithstanding all of our discussions of referenda Britain remains, you need the principal opposition or the principal party of government to move to create circumstances in which a second referendum could take place. And right now, neither the leader of the Labour Party nor the leader of the Conservative Party is particularly minded to go down that route.
The other question, of course, is what the referendum question is. I mean, is it a take or leave the negotiated deal, or is it a second referendum on whether or not you want to go forward with Brexit?
Yeah, I mean, I presume that an evil Remainer, an evil scheming Machiavellian Remainer, Ramona as they're called, would actually sort of arrange circumstances where, you know, Parliament does this, the Prime Minister can't have a general election, and the scenario you just set out is, okay, we'll put it back to the people. In which case, what would the question be?
Well, I think the only circumstance in which you get to that question is a profound constitutional crisis. Mm-hmm. And you can clearly imagine circumstances in which at that point the Prime Minister, if it's still Theresa May, says, well, let's put my deal to the people, and the alternative being no deal. I have to say I would be very surprised if the European Council at that point was prepared to extend the Article 50 process if it was only to ratify the deal that had been done rather than remain. But let's see, that may be a scenario. And I certainly think there would be a lot of voices agitating within the Labour Party to avoid that being the choice, because the Labour Party will already have rejected Theresa May's deal and clearly doesn't want to see no deal. So it would leave the Labour Party in something of a dilemma as to what to campaign for if that referendum came to pass. So I think you can conceive of circumstances where you could have a Conservative leader proposing a referendum as a choice between her deal and no deal, and a Labour Party a politician leading the opposition arguing at that point for Remain versus the Prime Minister's deal.
I think in the oldest parliamentary democracy in the world, I think it would be very difficult for a Prime Minister to take a deal that's been rejected in the House of Commons and put it to the people. Yep. I mean, I think that would be just a bizarre scenario. I think much more likely is that there will be a motion, I mean, if this plays out and if the deal is rejected in Parliament, that there will be an interim motion of no confidence in Theresa May, that she'll be deposed as leader, and then the DUP will do business with Boris Johnson or whoever to make them Prime Minister and have a second bite of the cherry. That's my prediction.
In which case, I would predict it to be 1.4 million people on the next march, not 700,000.
I think Lucinda's point's a fair one. I think there is every possibility Theresa May will not be the Prime Minister in the next few weeks and months, but I don't think we should read that as meaning there's going to be a change of government and a general election. Yeah. There's a very credible scenario that we see a change of Prime Minister, but both the DUP and the Conservative Party resisting the option of going to the country at that point.
And the DUP have not very subtly hinted at this in the last few weeks, where they have actually expressed an opinion and a preference for the next leader of the Conservative Party. So
this gets deeper into the populist problem. Let's just sort of go with that scenario, a DUP-backed, overtly pro-Brexit and Boris Johnson type government. The DUP is socially not progressive, to put it mildly. It's been described as the political arm of the 17th century. Its positions on various issues are not in tune with the larger public. That kind of scenario is also a constitutional breakdown scenario, isn't it? Isn't that insupportable in terms of...
I don't think it's an overstatement to say that we are in uncharted waters, and we will be in even more uncharted waters in circumstances where Parliament rejects all of the options. And, as I say, every one of the scenarios that we're describing, one is left slightly scratching one's head, thinking, well, the United Kingdom couldn't get to that place, could it? In a few weeks, we could be in exactly that place.
Mm-hmm. So isn't that Theresa May's sort of ultimate trump card with the Brexiteers? That actually, rather than their government being formed, we could have a general election and it could be Corbyn who's the next Prime Minister, in which case it's either my deal, it's Chequers or Corbyn. And that's a more persuasive argument than the DUP short-lived Brexiteer coalition.
But the position of the Brexiteers is that that threat is a false one because they will be able to vote down the deal and then not vote for the Fixed Term Parliament Act to be revoked. And so in that sense, that will certainly be a threat made by the whips, but they'll call their bluff at that point. And I think it's important to recognise this is a psychodrama and a civil war engulfing the British Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. Rationality only has a very small part to play in the drama that is unfolding within the Conservative Party right now.
I think it's important as well to understand the fear of the hardline Brexiteers. Their greatest fear is, for example, Theresa May's concession or proposal at the Council, the European Council last week to extend the transition period. That's the absolute disaster scenario for them. So they don't particularly want a deal. They're quite happy to end up with no deal because it's better than the alternative, which could be a prolonged transition that ultimately might lead to a soft Brexit, to the UK staying in the single market customs union. And that to them is not Brexit. So they are totally ideologically opposed to that. And I think it's fairly predictable that they would rather a no-deal scenario than a scenario that allows for potentially an election in a couple of years that would lead to even potentially another referendum or a soft Brexit. They don't want that.
And that was, I mean, there was a survey that came out a couple of weeks ago saying 87% of the people in Northern Ireland who supported Remain said the peace process was a price to pay to ensure Brexit happened.
Right. That's a cheerful thought. just very quickly, a couple of questions. One for you, Kim. You do a wonderful job as one of Britain's top diplomats, putting the best face on what Britain's up to. Would it be fair to say that's more difficult now than it was earlier in your career? And what ways do you have to manage the cognitive dissonance of the demands on your role?
Do I look like I'm aging fast?
you're doing well.
Thank you. Look, first of all, it's a privilege to be British Ambassador to the United States. It's I think, the best job in our system. So I am delighted to be here. It's a fascinating time to be in America. The Brexit story back in the UK has added an extra layer of complexity and challenge to the job, but I welcome it all, honestly, and thank you for your concern, but I'm fine.
Good answer. Well, I don't think we've fulfilled Barnier's goal of de-dramatising this, but we have, I hope, detoxified it. So thank you very much to the panel for a very good
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Brookings for providing this audio. If you haven't yet, please take a moment to share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a review and 5-star rating wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.